Welcome to the Marty and Laura Show. We're so excited to be joining you. We're here to talk about your dogs, your cats, and maybe even some small critters. Anything you've got a question?
We've got answers for all of it.
The Marty and Laura Show is brought to you by Veterinary Village. With locations throughout Wisconsin, Veterinary Village is dedicated to enhancing the quality of animal and human lives today and into the future.
Welcome to the Marty and Laura Show. We are so excited that you're here, and it's the holidays, and we're all just kind of free-forming, right? You know, that time between Christmas and New Year's. When it's kind of like you're at the airport, like, is it day? Is it night? Are we drinking? Are we not? Who knows? You know, like that. So
I don't even know what day it is, much less what time of the day it is.
No idea. It's all that whole week from Christmas to New Year. Definitely just a blur. So here we are in the blur. And so we thought it would be perfect timing to bring you. How you doing, Marty? Are you ready?
I'm ready to bring you a topic
about zebras. So now you have to explain why we're talking about zebras, Marty.
So there's a standing line in medicine, human and veterinary. When you hear hoofbeats, you should look for horses, not for zebras. Meaning, if you are presenting to your physician or your veterinarian with a condition, the first thing your veterinarian or physician should think about are the most common disorders that cause the syndrome that you're discussing.
Right.
But if they go through the whole list of differentials and they've been down the list of it could be this, 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 and they still haven't come up with a solution, then we start to look for zebras. A zebra meaning an unusual disorder or presentation for a condition, a medical condition that needs to be diagnosed and managed, because otherwise you kind of be in trouble. And there are many, many zebras, but we're going to talk about just a handful of them today. A couple of them for cats, a couple of them for dogs, just to give you something. Now, if you go to your veterinarian with this on your list, please don't look at them if they're kind of looking you back like you might be
crazy,
off the rails here. But there are definitely zebras that we see. And many of these, I've got 9 things on my list. Many of these, 7 of them are things that I've diagnosed. So it is not unheard of.
Right. Well, and just because they're zebras because they're unusual, not because they're extinct.
Right.
Okay.
Right. Zebras are not extinct.
Exactly.
And in Africa, they're pretty common.
There
you
go. But
here in the U.S., they're not. So when you hear hoofbeats, you look for horses, not for zebras.
But we're going to talk about some zebras. So let's start with cats. Let's do the 2 cat zebras.
Okay.
Like, what is my cat experiencing? What should it be? And when it's not that, what could it be?
Sure. So we'll start with a saddle thrombus, which isn't extremely rare, but I want to start with something that might actually be something that could happen. A saddle thrombus is when a cat has an underlying heart problem and it throws a blood clot that lodges in the bifurcation of the blood vessels to the back leg. So where the aorta splits to go to the femoral arteries, there's this blood clot. And for some reason, that's where they tend to lodge in cats. So they're not something that we see in dogs, but we do in cats with an underlying heart problem. And you may not have any awareness that the cat has a heart issue until you look at your cat and your cat is able to walk on their front end. They're alert. They're awake. They can use their front legs, but their back legs are painful, unable to use them. And their feet and toenails are cold and gray. And if you feel up in their inguinal region, up in the groin, to feel for a pulse, you can't feel one because that blood clot has formed there. And that will be the presentation. We probably see, I don't know, maybe one of these a year. So it's not super common, but it's certainly something that I've seen enough times to say we know exists. So it's not a complete off the wall, crazy, you'll never see this kind of thing. But the cats are painful. It's a very serious condition. They need immediate attention. Most of them, unfortunately, don't survive because it is the underlying heart problem and the blood clot that lead to the loss of blood flow to the back legs. And the underlying heart problem, of course, isn't something that's easy to resolve. So unfortunately, that's what it looks like. I've had one that came in, it looked like it had fallen down a flight of stairs, and indeed it might have. It might have started down the stairs, and the clot formed. That actually belonged to a veterinarian. The clot probably formed and dislodged from the heart and into the back legs, and the cat tumbled down the stairs. But you can see them in other conditions as well. So they'll look almost like they've had trauma because they're painful mm-hmm. and they can't use their back end. Mm-hmm. So it'll almost look like they've broken their back or broken their pelvis, but they don't have any blood flow to their back legs and their feet are cold. Their toenails are not the normal pink color. If you compare their front toenails to their back toenails, you can see a difference on those white colored toenails. And it's a pretty distinct diagnosis. So if it's a really young veterinarian, maybe they haven't seen one. If you're a pet owner, you probably haven't seen one of these. And they're most common, this is the most interesting part about this zebra, is they're most common in black cats.
I know. Why is that?
They think it has something to do with the melanin in the coat, stress levels, how they handle their heart disease, that kind of thing. But it's most common in black cats.
Wild.
I know.
Wild. Mm-hmm. Okay. That's definitely, that's a zebra, all right. So, okay. Black cats that can't walk on their rear, you should look for this blood clot. Wild.
Yeah.
Next up on the kitty zebras.
Next on the kitty zebras is something that's really bizarre, but not nearly as scary because it's not life-threatening. It's okay. called a rodent ulcer, rodent like rat, like, you know, mice and rats. And I think it got the name because of the appearance of it on the cat. Is it's almost always under the upper lip, like right underneath it. And the cats will come in with their lip kind of sticking out like this. And if you flip the lip open, you'll see this ulcerated lesion. It's usually symmetrical, but it can be more on one side than the other. It's actually an eosinophilic granuloma. So it's some kind of allergic reaction or immune reaction to something. And we call it rodent ulcers because people used to think that the cats would get it from biting mice right. or the mice
right.
biting them.
Right. That's what I thought.
But it's not. It just spontaneously happens. And we had one of these not too long ago in the practice. I walked in the exam room. I took one look at the cat and went, oh, yeah, rodent ulcer. Okay. So that's kind of the slang word for it. It's really an eosinophilic granuloma. And they can occur on other parts of the body. But they have this very characteristic look when they're on the lip. And my associate, my young associate, had previously seen the cat and didn't recognize it for what it is. Number one, because it didn't look quite as pronounced when she mm-hmm. saw the cat. Number two is because she's young and I'm old and I've seen them. And again, because it's an eosinophilic granuloma that is related to the immune system, they tend to respond to anti-inflammatories like steroids. Cats don't die from these. They can become affected with them in multiple locations, but typically they're just right here. And like I said, the cat just all of a sudden you look at it one day and it's just doing this. It's really kind of weird looking.
So we don't know what's triggering this?
It's some kind of an immune response is the best answer that I can give you.
Wow.
But, okay. you know, the immune system does funky things.
Yeah,
and so we see.
Welcome to someone who has yeah. many immune disorders. So I feel that.
Yeah. So cats can get them in other places. Cats can have other kind of lesions that are similar to this. But that's kind of that interesting one. So if you want to Google it and just put in images of cats with rodent ulcers, you will find hundreds, literally hundreds of pictures that come up on Google.
Wow.
When you look that up.
Okay. Those are some pretty great zebras. Now, I'm not a cat person, so a lot shocks me when it comes to cats. Like, mm-hmm. I don't know. So let's talk about some dog ones. What are some dog okay. zebras? I know you diagnosed one for me many years ago. Over the phone you diagnosed. So I know that this is a thing.
You lead off.
Well, in that one, it was a litter of baby puppies. And I had two baby puppies that were having some pretty severe neurological symptoms. Both puppies, it had been a very hard whelping. I thought they were puppies who had brain damage, basically.
Oxygen deprivation. Right.
Oxygen deprivation, and that we were going to have to euthanize them because they weren't going to come around. And I was very sad and upset, of course, and it was during COVID, and I couldn't get my regular veterinarian to come and do it, you know, in the time I wanted her to. And so I talked to Marty on the telephone and told her what was going on, and she said, well, I think it's this zebra thing. And it was toxoplasmosis, which is from eating cat poopy, correct?
Yeah, it could have been toxo or neosporum. We'll never know for sure.
We'll never know
who it was. But yes, it's a parasite from feces.
And so she said, here, give them these antibiotics. And if they get better, then you know that that's what it was. And literally 12 hours after the antibiotics, those puppies were up on their feet and it was a miracle. And everyone I've ever told this story to is like, wow, there's some zebras for you. And
for
the
sure.
puppies lived happy lives. They didn't have to be euthanized. So that was really amazing. Really
good.
Amazing.
So as long as we're talking about neurologic things, let's go ahead and do two neurologic things that we see in dogs.
Okay.
One is called a fibrocartilaginous embolism, or FCE for short. Oh. And that's where the dog will acutely, similar to the cat that we just talked about, acutely be unable to use one or both rear legs usually. Mm-hmm. And it's from a clot of cartilage, not a blood clot, but a clot of cartilage that somehow lodges into the spinal cord blood flow, and the dog will acutely be unable to use the leg. So again, it's pretty unusual. It can look very much like a slipped disc or trauma. Mm-hmm. But when you evaluate the dogs, or if you image them, if you spend the money on an MRI or a CT and do the imaging, you won't find those. But it's typically an FCE, or fibrocartilaginous embolism. And those dogs can have some real struggles to get better, mm-hmm. but eventually they will. If you can give them the nursing care that it requires to get them back up on their feet, you can keep them clean, keep them dry. It's a challenge when you have a dog that can't get up and move because they can't go out to urinate. They'll be hard nursing-wise to take care of because then urine in the stools can be complicated to take care of. So that's one neurologic thing that we can see. The other really interesting neurologic thing that we see is called coonhound paralysis. And again, it's neurologic. And it's called coonhound paralysis because it's most frequently seen in coonhounds, but not exclusively coonhounds. But it does seem to be related to the immune system's response to a raccoon bite or scratch. So even dogs that aren't coonhounds will tackle raccoons sometimes out in the yard or out in the field or on a walk or whatever, anywhere that they can get to them. And raccoons apparently are pretty fun prey for dogs to use. Yeah. So they will get bitten and scratched, and the dog will start off with an inability to use the back legs, which will then progress up the spinal cord to the front legs. So the dog is essentially like flat out down, and they can be down for 4, 6, 8 weeks at a time. And again, it's really a lot of intense nursing care and a lot of supportive care. Make sure they don't get a bladder infection. Make sure they empty their bladder. Make sure you keep their skin clean and dry. You know, carry him outside, carry him inside, all this stuff. I took care of one when I was a vet student, and I would take the dog out on a gurney and put him out in the yard because it was nice. It was spring. It was Iowa. So I'd take the dog out, and we'd hang out outside the vet school on the lawn just because the dog needed some fresh air. And so I'd hang out there, and people would come by, and they'd go, oh, my gosh, like, what a good dog, because he wouldn't get up. Well, he was paralyzed, so he couldn't get up. Gosh. They all thought I had this really amazing trained dog. I'm like, yeah, isn't he great? He's really good.
That's terrible.
But eventually he recovered, and I've had a number of them happen to us here in Wisconsin. Mostly they're the coonhound hunters, the people who hunt raccoon and bear and all those things, but not exclusively. One of them was a German Shepherd, and he had the same condition 3 times in his life. And I finally looked. He lived on one of my husband's dairy farmer's farms. He was his farm dog. He was his German Shepherd. And there were raccoons that would live in the rafters of the barn, and he would go up and tackle the raccoons. Like I said, apparently that's fun to do. I don't find it to be enjoyable, but the dog apparently did. And every time he got this coonhound paralysis, it took him longer and longer to recover. And I finally looked at the farmer, and I said, really seriously, you got to stop him from doing this, because the next time he may not make a recovery. So please find another way to get rid of the raccoons in your barn, because this is dangerous for poor Luke. Poor Luke had this happen to him multiple times. So that's another one of those really bizarre things. And like I said, it doesn't start like the dog isn't suddenly just down on all four. It starts off in the rear, and it progressively gets worse. And so it can look like a slipped disc with the spinal cord deteriorating because of the pressure of the disc. It can certainly happen from things other than a slip disc, but the dog will come in typically with scratches or bites on their front legs or their face or something. And so you kind of look at them and go, okay, wait a minute here. Is there a raccoon in this dog's history? And they go, yeah, as a matter of fact. So make sure if you go to your veterinarian with any of these conditions that you give them a complete history. Your vet isn't there to judge you. Your vet is there to make a diagnosis. It's right up there with, don't tell Dr. Greer that my dog got into my gummies or got into my marijuana stash. If you're not honest with us, we can't really help you. So if there's been a raccoon in your dog's history, share that information. If there's been a relative of your dog that's had any of these conditions, because we're going to talk about MMM next, that can have a genetic component to it. So if we aren't giving complete histories to our veterinarians, they're not going to get the information.
Well, and so, I think that's one of the reasons that buying your dog from a responsible purebred breeder, they know those histories. And if your dog has something, one of these zebras pop up, you can call your breeder and say, hey, is there any history of anything like this? And your breeder can give you that information to share with your veterinarian.
Right. And that's really valuable information for them to have.
Doggett simplifies the puppy buying journey by connecting families with the perfect breed and responsible, health-verified breeders. They are the only breeder marketplace that verifies health clearances and responsible breeding practices. Through their personalized puppy matcher tool and matchmaker services, they educate and guide buyers every step of the way, ensuring a seamless process and a perfect match for their lifestyle. From initial breed consultation to introductions with top breeders, Doggett makes responsible puppy ownership easy and stress-free.
So the next one is masticatory myositis. Are you familiar with this one?
No, this is the other two I've heard. This one
heard
is...
Sure. So masticatory myositis is when the muscles of the skull become acutely inflamed. And those are the muscles that the dog can open and close their mouth with and chew with. And so they'll come in sometimes initially with some swelling of their temporal muscles, the ones on their forehead. So they'll come in with swelling and the dog unable to open their mouth all the way and painful. So they'll open their mouth a little ways, but as it scars, they can't open their mouth fully. That does have a genetic component to it. It's more common in the northern breeds of dogs. There is a blood test for this one. There aren't blood tests for the other things that we've talked about, but this one has a blood test, and it's run at the UC San Diego campus, the Comparative Neuromuscular Lab, and it's in La Jolla, and you ask for the 2M test. And it's a blood test, so it has to go off, has to be run, takes a few days to get it back. But those dogs initially will be painful and swollen, and then as the swelling goes down, then the muscles will scar. And many of these dogs will go for months and months without being able to fully open their mouths. And then eventually, instead of swelling of those muscles, they'll start to sink in, and the dog will have kind of a caved-in look to their head. Now, we can see those caved-in looks also as dogs age, because they don't always age as gracefully as we'd like them to, so they lose some of their muscle tone. But again, that's something to be aware of, is if the dog is painful doing that. And then the other thing that this can be confused with is a retrobulbar abscess. Are you familiar with this one?
No. I'm still waiting for when they step on a rusty nail.
Oh, okay. So tetanus almost never happens in dogs. Dogs are very resistant to tetanus, so we don't vaccinate for it. I think one time ever in my career, I think I have had a case of it. I never was able to prove it, but we're pretty sure that that's what the dog had. Of course, horses, goats, and sheep, those animals are susceptible to tetanus, so we vaccinate them. Yeah, and people, but not that. So it's similar to lockjaw in that it can't open its mouth, but it's a different syndrome. So it's a different mechanism of action. But we can see retrobulbar abscesses. And in fact, Dr. Hutzebot had one of these earlier this week. Is typically what will happen is the dog will chew on a stick or a bone or something that they shouldn't probably have been chewing on. And a little sliver of it gets up behind that last molar and it forms an abscess. And then that abscess, the soft spot for it is back of the eye. And so the eye will, they'll come with their eye bulging a little bit forward. And again, painful, running a fever. These dogs are pretty uncomfortable. So those dogs will typically anesthetize, maybe take an x-ray, maybe with them under anesthesia, be able to probe around in the back of the mouth and see if we can find anything. They thought they found something on the x-ray. I'm not sure what the outcome of this case was because it was just the day before Christmas that we saw it, and I haven't talked to Dr. Hutz about since. But the dog will come in with a bulging eye, and it's different than glaucoma, because glaucoma, you'll have a bulging eye, but it'll be steamy and red. The cornea will be steam-colored, and the eye itself will be red, but this, the eye just looks like it's bulging. Then there's also a periorbital myositis, and I've only seen one of these cases. Again, it's a really bizarre neurologic condition, and it's an inflammatory condition of the muscles that circle the eye, so it's called periorbital because it's around the eye. Myositis. I saw this one time in a Labrador, and the dog looks at you like they look surprised, like their eyes are really wide open, and they both eyes are equally affected. They come with both eyes just like whoop, popped open, and I looked at this dog and thought, oh my goodness, like I have no idea what this is. So I was fortunate enough that my dentist is in Milwaukee, and his office is a block from the ophthalmologist that does dogs and cats. I care for animals in Milwaukee. So I called her up and I said, can I come in and show you this picture? And she took one look at it on my phone and goes, yep, periorbital myositis. And those dogs will respond to steroids. So it's very different than both eyes. It's very different right. than an infection. You know, these things all have some nuances to them that
right.
they all sound like they're affecting something similar on the head, but they're all mm-hmm. very, very different from one another. And the diagnostics and the treatment are different. Mm-hmm. So it's important that you know that. And then we have Horner's syndrome. Again, not super rare, but Horner's syndrome is similar to Bell's palsy in people, where the dog will be fine one day, and then the next day they have, it's three things that actually turn into four. It's the nerve that comes off out of the spinal cord. Okay. It has some kind of damage to it. So it will cause the eye to drop back in the socket. The eyelids, therefore, will not be as wide open. The pupil will be smaller, and the third eyelid comes up. So all the four of those things will happen with Horner's syndrome. Again, it happens all of a sudden. The dogs are completely happy, don't feel bad, don't feel painful, don't run a fever. They're very happy. There's no blood test for that. There's no x-ray for that. There's no diagnostics for it other than looking at the dog and going, oh, yep, that's Horner's syndrome.
And does almost it resolve like Bell's palsy?
Yeah, usually it does. But you go to bed one night and the dog will look fine. You get up in the morning and the dog's like this. And you're like, what happened? Like, did you get poked in the eye? Did something happen? Right. Do you have an ulcer? Right. But the third eyelid is up and it's a non-painful condition. It just looks really strange. So
wild.
That's sort of a whole little cluster of things that we can see coming in. And, you know, the head is, because we look at our dogs all the time and we pet them and all those things, you know, we're very aware of things that happen on the front end of the dog, probably more often than the things that happen on the back end of the dog.
Well, and on their legs and stuff.
So
like,
I think,
they're always looking at their little faces.
Right. Right. So I think those are kind of interesting. Let's see. As long as we're talking about heads and tails, let's throw in limber tail or cold tail. You know that.
Cold tail. I know this one well.
Yeah. Okay.
And I still want to know if anybody has any reason why this happens. I was a professional handler, right? So I shed a lot of dogs. And the worst one were the Akitas. Like, you'd give them their bath. They'd be fine. You'd give them their bath. You'd dry them. And for whatever reason, and if your Akita doesn't put its tail up, it's disqualified from the ring. So this is a problem.
Mm-hmm. For sure. So, mostly we see it after swimming, but we can see it after bathing.
Mm-hmm. I know you can see it after bathing.
I have a better explanation for swimming than bathing. After swimming, and it's almost always Labradors, and I think Labradors use their tail as a rudder differently than other animals do. And so I think most of the time on those that they've pulled a muscle or a pair of muscles underneath their tail from ruddering around in the water. Because when you feel them underneath the tail, that muscle is swollen and painful, and the dogs will not raise their tail. If you do lift it, they screech. I mean, it's pretty painful for the dog.
Horribly painful.
And typically within 2 or 3 days of anti-inflammatories, Medicam, Remedil, steroids, anti-inflammatories, please do not give ibuprofen to your dogs. Please do not give Tylenol to your dogs. Do not give anything to your dog without your veterinarian's permission. But typically those dogs will be better pretty quickly. But we call it cold tail, limber tail. Mm-hmm. There's a number of different terms for it.
Dead tail.
I hardly ever see it in, I mean, golden retrievers, they swim too, but we just don't see it. I think it has to do with the feathering and the...
I've seen it in goldens. I've seen it in Akitas. I've even seen it in wirehairs.
Yeah.
I always just assumed it was like a muscle cramp. You know what I'm saying? But I don't know.
I think so.
I don't know.
But why the bathing? I can understand swimming if you're using
because
those muscles.
I can't understand
bathing.
I don't know. Cold water. Because, I mean, if you're at the dog show, sometimes you don't have the luxury of a warm bath. Right.
Sometimes. What do you mean sometimes? That's like a
most
lot.
Of the time. Unless you have the luxury of taking your dog to the Purina show complex outside of St. Louis that has lovely heated bathing tubs. Most of the time, if you have to give your dog a bath or fluff it up or whatever you're going to do, it's like a hose pipe and the water's coming from the ground. So it's not warm necessarily.
Nope. Pretty chilly. Mm. So yeah, those are really not that unusual. But if you have never seen it before, we have people that come in and they're pretty hysterical. Yeah, they are scared. And so they'll come in and they'll instantly want an appointment. And so, you know, sometimes you just have to realize, oh yeah, I think I heard about that on the Marty and Laura show. I think I can relax about it.
Yep. Absolutely.
All right. Then we have another cardiac thing. I think we should hit that before we hit the last two. The cardiac thing is right atrial tumor, and it's typically a hemangiosarcoma. So you all know, you know what hemangiosarcoma is, the tumor that forms in the blood vessels, most often on the spleen. Mm-hmm. And those dogs will come in with sometimes acutely weakened. They'll collapse out in the yard. They'll collapse going up or down the stairs. Mm-hmm. Some of them you'll find mm-hmm. them by the time you come home and you find them, they're already deceased. It happens very, very suddenly if they have a splenic tumor that bleeds out acutely. But there is a form of it that can develop in the right atrium of the heart. And it's mm-hmm. almost always the right atrium. And the atrium of the heart is, remember, the heart has four chambers, two atria and two ventricles. So remember your biology. And so the right atrium of the heart, because this is a vascular tumor in the spleen, it also can be in the blood vessels of the chamber of the heart. And so the dog will have a tumor in there, and then that tumor will start to leak blood like it will if it's a hemangiosarcoma in the spleen. And the blood will leak into the pericardial sac. So the heart is surrounded by this very dense tissue called the pericardium, and the blood will leak out. And every time the heart beats, a little bit more bleeds out, and then the heart can't expand because it's being compressed by the blood that's leaking into this pericardial sac. And so the dogs will come in pretty suddenly in heart failure. And unfortunately, even with aspiration of the fluid, the blood out from there, or doing a little window in the pericardial sac, most of those dogs don't have a long-term survival. Mm-mm. So those are usually pretty acute and pretty serious. Probably the most famous one of these was on the Super Bowl a few years ago. WeatherTech, the company that makes the floor mats,
right,
the U.S.-made floor mats in Chicago, they had their own personal dog. The people who own the company had their own personal dog that had this pericardial effusion and a right atrial tumor. And they took him to the University of Wisconsin, and Wisconsin was able to treat him and keep him going for about 6 months. Wow. But they put an ad on the Super Bowl, and I have to give them a call out because this was absolutely amazing. They spent however much a Super Bowl ad costs, a million or whatever it is, they spent that much money to advertise the cancer center at the University of Wisconsin because they were so impressed with the level of care that their dog received at UW. So they've got a great cancer center there. I hope you never, those of you in the area, I hope you never need to know it. I hope you never need to use it, but be aware of that. And yes, the dog still succumbed to his disease, but they were able to buy him some pretty good quality of life time. So again, it's more common to see it just in the spleen, but it can also happen in the heart. And when my radiologist comes to the practice and ultrasounds the spleen, she always puts the probe on the chest as well to take a look to see if there's a tumor up there. So I think it's important that that's the case, that if you do have a dog with hemangiosarcoma, that you know that there may be other ramifications beyond just what's happening in the abdomen.
Yeah.
Pretty serious stuff.
Yeah. Hemangio is just
everybody. It's a pretty nasty disease.
Having
and
lost
unfortunately,
a number of dogs to it over the years, hemangio is just really one of my least favorite things.
It's bad. And, you know, they've worked and worked and worked to find a cure for it. There is a drug treatment that slows it. It's called propranolol. It's actually a cardiac drug. And Yabi Mariano, who's been doing the research at University of Minnesota, has got a protocol for adding propranolol to the treatment protocol of these dogs. It's not going to save their life, but it does seem to slow their progression of disease. So, again, it's not an expensive drug. It is something your veterinarian has to prescribe. But if you have a dog that has hemangiosarc and it's not operable, then it is something to consider as one of your treatment options to buy yourself some time.
Well, and that's if you catch it before it's already burst. I mean, you know.
Right. Well, in December this month, I had four dogs come through the door with splenic tumors in the same 10-day period of time. So they're not uncommon. One of them had already metastasized very extensively. One of them was an elderly dog and they opted not to do anything. Two of them went to surgery. And one came back a hematoma, and not a hemangiosarcoma, but it was a bleeding mass on the spleen. And the other came back with a disorder I've never even heard of, but it's supposed to be localized to the spleen, and splenectomy is supposed to be curative. So every mass on the spleen isn't necessarily a death sentence, but most of the time it is. Yeah. The fourth one, the one I just mentioned that came back, something I'd never heard of before, was kind of interesting because she was in for a different condition, and I just had her on the ultrasound table. And every time I put a dog on my ultrasound table, I take a good look at the spleen because it's right there in front of me. If I'm looking at the bladder, I'm trying to find out if they have a bladder stone. I'm going to just buzz back and take a look at the spleen. And this was a dog that has some neurologic disorders, so she was not real happy about being on the table because she got dizzy. It wasn't her fault. She would get dizzy because of the position we put her in. So I went back into the exam room, and I talked to the client. And they, after much debate, decided to take her to surgery, and she is recovered and doing really, really well. Amazing. But again, you know, these elderly dogs, it's a really hard decision to make. Yeah. Do I take this dog to surgery? Is this the right thing to do for the dog? And they're not always easy answers. My radiologist says they all come back as cancer, but I don't know that that's necessarily true. I think most of them do.
Yeah.
So it's worth a try, but it's a scary proposition.
I've been there, done that. And it is.
Yeah. And it's, it is common. That's not, yeah, it's not a zebra to have a tumor in the spleen. It's a zebra to have a non-hemangiosarcoma in the spleen.
Exactly.
So yeah.
Exactly.
So there's those. And then we have two other things that I want to just mention because they came from the AKC Parent Club meeting.
Oh, okay.
One of them, Dr. Dan Needle at New Hampshire, the veterinary diagnostic lab at New Hampshire's lab, has determined that the 2023 mystery respiratory disease that we saw in dogs, we thought it maybe was influenza or some other disorder. He presented at the AKC Parent Club meeting, and they believe that what they have found is a mycoplasma that has not previously been reported in dogs that typically will respond to doxycycline. It causes a respiratory disease condition similar to kennel cough. Kennel cough is sort of a garbage can diagnosis, and it's not rare. Kennel cough is pretty common, but it just means your dog has a virus or a bacterial infection, which could be one of 12 or 14 different organisms. But they believe this mystery disease that was seen in 2023 is probably a mycoplasma that has yet to be named. I'm guessing he's going to name it after himself. I think he should. But it's Dr. Dan Needle, no S on the end, Dr. Dan Needle, and he is still looking for samples of dogs that have respiratory disease that aren't responding to their treatment. So his recommendation is if you go to the vet with respiratory disease, ask them to swab the dog's throat, their pharynx, save the culture swab for about a week. And if a week into treatment, the dog is still not better, that he wants those samples sent to the New Hampshire lab. It's the CoLab, C-O-L-A-B lab. So that's something for people to be aware of, that if they have this mystery cough that all of a sudden a bunch of dogs, and at this time of year, people have boarded their dogs, they've groomed their dogs, all these dogs have been in contact with each other, we're likely to see an outbreak at this time of year. So be aware that that is something to take a look at. So you can Google Dr. Dan Needle, CoLab, New Hampshire, bring up his contact information. Please have your veterinarian contact him. He doesn't want to hear from people that aren't veterinarians because they need to have that communication to make sure that this sample gets sent to them correctly. And then the other thing was a liver fluke that was discussed, and I had never even heard of this thing. It's called Heterobilharzia americana, and it's a liver fluke mostly seen in the Colorado River Valley. So Colorado, Texas, that area where the Colorado River drains into. It's a liver fluke that causes some really odd GI signs, but what's most unique about it is when you x-ray or ultrasound the dog, the entire intestinal tract lights up like a Christmas tree in a way that no other organism has ever been determined to do that. So again, if you're having GI problems with your dog and your vet images the dog and goes, huh, I don't know what this is, it's probably because they don't know what it is because it's a pretty rare liver fluke. But it does exist in the United States. It does happen in certain parts of the country. So if you've been traveling in that area or you live in that area and you have a dog with GI disease and these symptoms that show up, you can take a look, and it's Heterobilharzia americana. So you very easily Google that,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, sure. Y'all just spell that. Come on, double dog dare you.
I've got it written down. I could.
We'll have it in the show notes, guys.
Right. If it happens, then again, that's something to take a look at. Ask your veterinarian to test for it. It is not routinely tested for on fecal exams. It can be really difficult to chase down. It can be a little bit tricky to diagnose and treat. But if that's what you've got going on and your veterinarian is scratching their head because it's a zebra, then you can pipe up and say, well, maybe we could talk about if it would be this. So please don't go in with a giant stack of things printed off of Dr. Google to your veterinary clinic and say, the Marty and Laura show said I should do this because I'll be in big trouble with your vet. But if you are seeing some of these things, I mean, it's never a bad conversation to have with a client about what they have come up with for some ideas. But please don't overstep, because your vet does not want you thinking that Dr. Google is smarter than they are.
No.
Because right now it's not. Now, at some point, AI is probably going to eclipse what we can do. But for right now, we're not there yet. So make sure you know that your veterinarian is still the ultimate expert and the ultimate decision maker. But it's never a bad idea to say, you know, we were at the Colorado River and my dog has symptoms that could fit with this. Or my dog was boarding and the respiratory disease isn't getting better. Or some of these things. So at least, you know, entertain the conversation, but please do not go in with a giant pile of paperwork and blame me for it, because I don't want to have your veterinarian calling me saying,
you know, always stop. Remember, the Marty and Laura show does not replace regular veterinary care.
No, it sure doesn't. And nobody can do it over the phone exclusively. You know, you have to have a certain amount of in-person insight. But it is kind of helpful to have some of this information, because it's just, there are zebras out there. So,
yeah.
And I'm just going to throw this in, because one of my very favorite books has nothing to do with being a doctor, even though it sounds like it does. And it's called How Doctors Think. And it is not written for doctors.
Right.
It is written for patient advocates. And that may be yourself, for yourself, mm-hmm. or that may be yourself for a family member or a friend. But I'm going to tell you, it's written by Jerome Groopman, and it is one of my favorite all-time books. I've read it multiple times. I've given away at least a dozen copies. And it's a really important book for how medical oversights happen, not mistakes as much as just how things don't always get a linear diagnosis. Gene Dodds always says, don't believe in coincidences. And I think that's a pretty accurate assessment, is that if one thing happened, then the next thing happened, you probably should at least look at if there's a correlation with it. But How Doctors Think is an amazing book. If you have anybody that you're caring for that you need to be an advocate for, please get the book. Please read it before you need it. It is an incredible read, and it helps you understand how physicians and veterinarians have to work through the algorithm in their brain, which will eventually be replaced by the algorithm of Google. But that doesn't mean that AI is going to replace us, and that doesn't mean AI is always going to be right. So just keep in mind that that's going to be the case for a lot of people, is that be sure you are sharing the right information with your veterinarian and not going in with a predetermined diagnosis.
Absolutely. All right, you guys. That's a lot of zebras to fit into one show. It's like a herd of zebras. And I love zebras. We have here by me the wildlife safari where you can actually see real zebras. It's fantastic. But this is a little bit different. So hope you enjoyed hearing about all the things that it might be and that are not what you thought it was. So thank you, Marty.
Bye.
Everybody have a great week. We'll talk to you next time.
Thank you for joining us on the Marty and Laura Show. We're excited to bring you these unique, fun, fact-based conversations about pet health. From pro tips on selecting your new dog to what your cat's cough means and what you should do about it. We'll meet you wherever you are, in the car, on the treadmill, walking the dog. And we'll bring you a good laugh, a great story, and a bright idea every week. We hope you'll join us on social. Stop by the website to sign up for an extra tip of the week for your pet. While you're at it, do us a favor, please, and leave a review wherever you find your podcasts. The Marty and Laura Show is produced by Pure Dog Talk, Inc. Sound design and editing by Premium Audio Services.